from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, Van Jones is well known in the Bay Area for founding and leading several locally based social justice and environmental groups. He rose to national fame through his work on green jobs, which took him all the way to Washington, where he served as an advisor in the Obama White House. His recently published book is Rebuild the Dream. It's both a memoir and a call to action around his latest passion, student debt and foreclosures. Van Jones joins us. That's next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Van Jones joins us for this Forum Hour, no stranger to the Bay Area. He worked for years in Oakland and throughout the Bay Area as a social justice activist, investigating police misconduct, and as an environmentalist and green economy pioneer. He spent 6 months as a special advisor on green jobs in the Obama White House. A Yale Law School graduate, he was selected by Time Magazine as an environmental hero and one of the 100 most influential people, and currently he serves on the boards of the National Resource Defense Council and the Robert F. Kennedy Center for Justice and Human Rights. Author of The Green Collar Economy, he founded Green for All in 2008 and launched Rebuild the Dream in 2011, an organization dedicated to rescuing the American middle class, now with 600,000 online members. His recently published book is titled Rebuild the Dream, and he joins us in studio for this hour. And good to see you back here. Welcome.
Oh, it's good to be back.
Well, let's begin by talking about your metamorphosis. You described it as from going from outsider to insider, back to outsider, but you've actually kind of gone from maybe a sort of would-be revolutionary, I suppose, in many ways, to a guy believing in responsible capitalism.
Well, you know, anything can happen. I do talk about in the book that whole transition and that journey. I grew up in a small town. My dad was a cop in the military, and then he got out and started running a kind of a tough.
This is in Tennessee.
Yeah, in Tennessee, running kind of a real tough little public school there that he turned around. And when I got to Yale Law School and saw the difference between what he told me America was about and all the poverty and some of the racism, I went to the left side of Pluto, and you know, proud of it.
And you don't mean the Disney character?
No, I don't mean the Disney character. But yeah, you know, but proud of it. You know, the great thing about being in a country like this is you can think whatever you want, try out new ideas, and you're free to do that. You're free to change your mind too. And what I burned out on some of the politics of outrage and confrontation, and found that I wanted to do some of the stuff my dad had done as far as actually creating real opportunity for people. And that's how I got into the green jobs thing, and the rest is history.
Yeah, your dad really, in some ways, well, the two of you kind of locked horns over this. I know you have a great deal of respect and love for your father. It comes through in your book. And I heard you talking about it, Esalen. I actually teared up talking about him. But there's a sense that one gets that you didn't really sort of cotton to the idea that a lot of poverty and a lot of recidivism could be ameliorated by jobs, and came around to his way of thinking.
Well, yeah, it's one of those things where, I mean, I think a lot of folks, you know, you wind up seeing the wisdom of your parents' words later in life. I mean, I really, and I still believe, and my dad believed as well, we just had different points of emphasis, that you know, society has a responsibility to make it possible for young people to make it, but also young people have to put forward the effort. So, you know, I talk about, you know, every child has to climb that ladder out of poverty themselves. You can't just give a kid some money and say, well, now you're not poor. Because if the kid's still poor in their heart or in their spirit, they'll be broke again tomorrow. They've got to do that effort themselves. But what my dad pointed that out, but he also talked about the importance of there being a ladder for that child to climb. And my big problem now, why I wrote the book, is I look at somebody like my dad who, you know, grew up in, you know, poor, segregated South. How would a kid like him today get into the middle class? It used to be you go to college, you get a job, you buy a home, and then you're safe. You're in the middle class. Well, now, look, you know, you go to college, you graduate with tons of crushing debt, you graduate off a cliff into the worst economy since the Great Depression. You know, African Americans, women, other minorities, you would often get a public sector job, school teacher, post office. Well, those jobs are under fire. and then you get a house. Well, that might be a trap door from the middle class into poverty because you got so many homes now that are underwater. So all the strategies that were available to my father plus affirmative action are not there. And so how do we build pathways now out of poverty into the middle class? And how do we, frankly, keep people who are in the middle class from falling into poverty? Those have got to be the questions that we take on now. And, you know, my journey has kind of brought me to a point where, having been in the White House for 6 months and seeing some of the misfires between the progressive movement and the grassroots versus the White House and how both were misunderstanding each other, I thought I had something to say, so you know, I put it in this book.
Well, you have a lot to say, and I want to get into what you have to say specifically about those two stools of the American dream. I mean, yeah. Two legs of the stool of the American dream, specifically owning a home and getting the college education would enable you to find a job. But you also talk a lot about job creation, and let me just focus on that with you for a moment and how the government has to play that role. And yet what we're hearing and what we've heard consistently from the Republican side of the fence is that no taxes lead to job creation. I mean, how does that compute in your head?
Well, you know, it's an amazing thing to kind of see this complete rewriting of American history. You know, these people, you know, we're patriots. We believe in America. We want to go back to the way things always were. But I don't know what they're talking about. If you look at the so-called American century, where we built this mass middle class, first one in human history, we built on-ramps, you know, for people of color, for women into that middle class. We protected the air and the water. We got children out of factories and put them into public schools. That wasn't individual people running around doing whatever they wanted to and refusing to pay their taxes. That was a nation saying, we're going to educate a whole generation of Americans, a couple of them, so they can outcompete the world. And we're going to be a nation of neighbors. We're going to stand together here. And I think that this sort of wacky, made-up American history that now gets kind of paraded out as a sort of cheap patriotism is probably the most dangerous ideology for the country right now, because if you don't understand how we built the middle class and how we created pathways out of poverty into the middle class, when somebody shows up with a wrecking ball to smash down all those institutions, to smash down the unions, to smash down public education, and they paint that wrecking ball red, white, and blue, people will think these people actually care about the country. And my view is that there are deeper patriots who don't use that language, but who have been fighting for liberty and justice for all for a long time. Many of us call ourselves progressives, but I'm starting to just call ourselves what we are. We're the deep patriots that stand up for the best in the country, and these extremists who are trying to smash down all the institutions that my parents and grandparents used and yours did, those people should be opposed, and they should be opposed not just because it's bad for the kids to make college unattainable. It's bad for the country to make college unattainable for a whole generation.
What about your patriotism or your feeling for your country now? You write in the book, when you went to Yale, you felt ashamed and angry at your country, and particularly seeing the poverty in New Haven and all of that. And I remember, in fact, as many do, and as certainly many on the right remind us constantly, that Michelle Obama after Iowa said, for the first time, I'm proud of my country. Do you feel proud of your country?
Well, I do. And part of the thing is that those feelings of anger and frustration and disappointment, that's a part of, I think, anybody's journey. If they're a sensitive person, if most of us who are on the left were the most idealistic kids when we were little. We were the ones who probably teared up singing the national anthem and "This land is your land" and took all that stuff really seriously and took it to heart. And when you get out, you grow up and you see the heartbreak, you see the gap between what we're promised and what actually happens in the country. If you don't get angry, there's something wrong with you. If you don't go through that period of heartbreak and disappointment, there's something wrong with you.
Talking again with Van Jones, his new book is Rebuild the Dream, former advisor on green jobs for the Obama administration and founder of the group's Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. He'll be speaking at the Commonwealth Club tonight at 6:30 p.m. So let's talk about student debt and mortgages, the ways to the American dream, because now we have more, a lot of people don't know this, more student debt than we have actually consolidated credit card debt in this country, which is a mind-boggling thing. But they're talking about doubling the interest rates. And not only that, but in the Federal Housing Finance Agency, you've got the acting director that you're kind of trying to lobby to reduce underwater mortgages. How are we doing on those two fronts, just those specific fronts?
Sure. Well, first of all, you do have this ongoing crisis with regard to foreclosures and this problem. We have 11 million homes in America that are underwater. In other words, the banks are overcharging them now. They were evaluated during that fantasy bubble period. Now reality's caught up to the families, but not to the banks. And so the banks are overcharging more than 11 million people. We are putting pressure on Fannie and Freddie. there's this guy named Ed DeMarco. He's a holdover from the Bush administration. He's still in the Obama administration. He oversees Fannie and Freddie. We're saying, listen, this guy is an ideologue. He refuses to listen to the good counsel of economists now across the board, Reagan advisors, Clinton advisors, who say, cut the principal. Cut the principal on these underwater mortgages. That puts $90 billion back in the pockets of Americans, but would create 1 million jobs. Why? When your home's underwater, you're not going to go buy a sofa. You're not going to go do a remodeling. You're not going to spend money in that local economy. This one guy, Ed DeMarco, is holding back $90 billion of savings for Americans and 1 million jobs. So we're putting pressure on him. He needs to change his mind or change,
how are you doing
his,
that?
Change his job. Well, I'm a part of an organization called RebuildTheDream.com. The book is Rebuild the Dream, and the organization is RebuildTheDream.com. And we've got about 600,000 people signed up. We're one of the fastest-growing progressive groups in the country. We're in every congressional district, and we've been putting public pressure. We did a press conference with a bunch of congresspeople, emails, petitions, phone calls, to put pressure on him to do this. And we think that we will actually be able to prevail. Actually, some members of the Obama administration have now been coming out. Sean Donovan from HUD saying it's time to cut the principles.
You've been given a lot of identification with the Occupy movement, though you've said publicly, you know, there's no real leader to this movement. I'm certainly not a leader to this movement. But a lot of your goals are in line with the Occupy movement. And yet the Occupy movement, unlike the Tea Party, hasn't brought itself into a kind of lobbying or hasn't consolidated whatever its ideology is in a way or had leadership. And I mean, in some respects, that really needs galvanizing, doesn't it?
Well, first of all, I always say I don't speak for Occupy. I will speak up for Occupy when they come under vicious attack from people who don't want to see any progress in America. I think that the Occupy movement is doing great on its own. They remind me of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in a lot of ways. Those young, idealistic people in the 60s.
But no Stokely Carmichael.
Maybe that's an improvement, though, to not have a single person to become sort of this you know, figurehead. I think that, first of all, back in the 60s, they occupied the lunch counters. They occupied the segregated buses. They helped Mississippians occupy the voting booths. And they were a center of energy and inspiration. But SNCC was not the entire civil rights movement. And Occupy is not the entire movement of the 99%. 99% is a pretty big number. It's a lot of people. And so the rest of us, rather than saying, well, Occupy should do this and Occupy should do that, we should applaud them for what they've been able to achieve. Their experiments with direct democracy, I think, have been inspiring. And then the rest of us should do the things that we believe are also effective. I think you got to have, and I saw this when I was in the White House, you can't change the country from D.C. down. You've got to have a bottom-up and a top-down. So those of us who believe in voting and peaceful protest need to now step up and make sure that both are happening.
Bottom-up movement calling for a sustainable economy, more jobs, Wall Street accountability, and path to prosperity for more Americans. That's really what the movement is all about that Van Jones is building and Rebuild the Dream. And let's take the SNCC analogy, though. You know, SNCC came under a lot of fire when they started talking about being more militant and maybe going from being the Nonviolent Coordinating Committee to using, well, Malcolm X-type rhetoric, any means necessary or whatever. There's some sense of that danger in the Occupy movement. I mean, we hear it certainly from the right, but, you know, what's happened in Oakland, for example, things got out of hand, and they may not have even been members of the Occupy movement. A lot of people came there, you know, just looking for trouble, but there is that danger.
Well, I think that's true for any movement. I think, you know, the great thing about the Occupiers is they speak for themselves very well. And so I definitely encourage you to have them on and help them.
Oh, they have been on, yeah.
Oh, that's good. From my point of view, I'm focused now on how do we go from anger to answers. We went from hopeful, from hopey to mopey. You know, we went from hope to heartbreak after the election. And then people got angry, which is, I think, is a natural step. But how do we go to answers? Not only are we pushing back around the home mortgage problem, but we also are focused on this question of student loans. And if we have a second, I'd love to talk about that because that's another huge.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Yeah. Well, listen, most of us, you know, we went to college and we got out. We had, you know, some debt. And so we assume that the same thing's happening with these young people today. It's a completely different scenario. You got young people graduating now with $25,000, $50,000, $75,000 in debt for a BS or for a BA. It costs more money now to go to UC Berkeley than to Harvard. You mentioned that the student debt, this month we will hit 1 $1 trillion in student debt. Young people walking around with that much debt trying to start their lives, they're not going to buy a house. They're not going to buy a car. They're already maxed out.
And if they're a liberal arts major, the likelihood of getting a job becomes even more diminished than it ever was.
And so it's
almost like you have two classes. You have those kids who go to school and study computer science or study finance. They get jobs. And then the ones who study philosophy and history find themselves often not finding jobs.
And so that is a big problem. And from my point of view, you should take the situation and make it better. What's going to happen if we don't act is on July 1st, this nightmare scenario is going to get worse. The most important student loans are arguably the Stafford subsidized student loans. Those are the loans that the low-income kids who are smart enough, support enough to get into college but can't afford it get. Those loans are about to go from 3.4% interest to 6.8%. Now, can you imagine? The banks and the richest people in the country are getting their money for almost free. And Congress is going to sit back and let the student interest rate double on the most needy and most worthy young people in our country, the ones who are trying to go to college. 6.8%. About 8 million young people will be affected. It will suck $20 billion out of their pockets over the course of their lives. They don't have a nickel to spare. Congress can act. Congress can, rebuildthedream.com. We're taking action now. To tell Congress, don't let this happen to this young people. We're the only country in the world that's making it harder for our young people to get educated. India, China, Brazil, Germany are all saying, listen, our young people are going to have to compete in a global market. We're going to educate them up the wazoo. And we are putting up more barriers to young people getting educated, making it more expensive, making it tougher. Again, that's not just bad for the kids. That's bad for the country. I want to be able to retire at some point, and I want these young people to be well-educated and coming up with the products of the future and making a lot of money paying taxes so I can retire. It won't happen if we keep throwing these young people overboard.
You learned a lot at the White House. 6 months there, you learned the way things work or don't work. And you're still a fairly strong, ardent advocate of green jobs as a necessity for not only the economy, but as a necessity to move forward. What do you say when you mentioned China just a moment ago? I think this is some of what you said when people say, well, look at Solyndra, and they'll throw that up as, a big failure of green jobs. But it comes back to China in many ways, doesn't it?
Yeah, sure. One of the things that I just find so disappointing is that the Solyndra thing, which the president's opponents and the enemies of clean energy have just tried to make into a household name. The reality of that is that loan program was a George W. Bush loan program. George W. Bush put that program together in 2007. I know because the Green Jobs Act was also a part of the same energy bill. So I know that loan program very well. This president put the money into it. It had 99% success rate, except for Solyndra. Well, first of all, you've got to be able to have some failure rate if you're going to be investing in new technologies. But more importantly, what's the real story? The real story is our $2.4 billion loan program went up against a $30 billion grant program from China. China saw this president moving in a green direction, saw us bobbling the ball on cap and trade, and tripled down to stop us. So they're now flooding the world with cheap solar to wipe out American companies. That's what's going on. Now, rather than our Republican friends saying, hold on a second, our American energy companies are under attack from China. Let's stand together. Let's make sure that we go to the WTO. We keep them from doing this. They use it to score cheap political points against the president. Now, I don't call that patriotism. You can call that a lot of things. Maybe it's smart politics. But it's not patriotism.
It's also ironic when you think of how in debt we are to China. You're talking about student debt. and yet they're making it harder in many respects for the American economy, but that's a whole other program. Talk about, the Glenn Beck altercations. You write about it in the book. You became enemy number one to him, and you describe it as, to some extent, some confusion on his part of the role that you played in his not getting advertising and all of that.
Sure. Well, as I've said many times, Glenn Beck is sort of like Mr. Rogers meets Darth Vader. He creates this kind of crazed universe with all these different characters in it. And the characters just happen to have the same names as real people, like Barack Obama or Van Jones or George Soros. But that's where the everything stops there, and he just kind of makes up a bunch of stuff. For me, it was surprising because he was on Fox. And that's a big, it's one of our biggest news outlets in the world, or alleged news outlets in the country. And he was saying stuff that just was patently not true about me, about the
He said you were a felon.
He said I was a convicted felon. He said I was all kind of stuff. And so
you were arrested once, right?
Well, I was detained and by the SFPD at a peaceful protest and actually got paid, believe it or not. I'm one of few people I know that actually got paid for an unlawful arrest because it was so unlawful. But my view about it is that we at that time we were going through a big change in the information system in America. And people like the Glenn Becks of the world, the late Andrew Breitbart, and others figured out, hey, you can kind of prank the system, sort of like Ashton Kutcher style, kind of prank the system. You can edit videos, you can say outrageous stuff, you can get a bunch of noise going. The information system, very advanced. The wisdom system, not so advanced yet. So I think we've finally caught up to these pranksters. Beck is no longer on the air. He says all kind of stuff, but he's behind a paywall somewhere.
He called Obama a racist, didn't he?
Yeah. I mean, he said stuff that nobody had ever said about a U.S. president with that kind of a platform. And eventually it cost him his job. In the meantime, he went on his war path against me. But, part of the thing now, is trying to look forward. Why is there so much anxiety out there? Why is there so much hatred? Why is there so much fear-mongering? Why is it working? I think it's because we're going through a big transition in our economy. I was teaching at Princeton last year, and this year I just signed on with Presidio, which is one of the green business schools in America. Presidio's right here.
Yeah, I gave a commencement speech there.
I got you. Yeah. Well, one of the great jewels.
Yeah, it's in San Francisco.
Yeah, right here in San Francisco, one of the great jewels. Well, I just signed on to be visiting faculty there because we're trying to sort out now how we can build an economy that can work, because if you can put Americans back to work, you can pull Americans back together.
But when I gave the speech there, I kept thinking, all these MBAs are coming out of here. It's all ecological, environmental, and all good training in terms of combining that with business. And I thought, where are the jobs for them? The same thing.
But here's the great thing about it is that is actually, despite the fact that Congress has been missing in action and D.C. has been kind of stuck on stupid, that is the part of the economy that's growing. The Brookings Institute, no radical left-wingers, Brookings. Put out
need apply.
Exactly. But they put out a report, I think about 4 or 5 months ago, saying we have 2.4 million green jobs in America right now. Now, let me just break that out for people. In the coal mines right now, our heroes who are keeping the lights on, risking their lives, they have 80,000 of them, America's heroes. There are 100,000 people working today in the solar industry right now in America. There's another 100,000 working in the wind industry. There's 2.4 million total if you put in the smart batteries, recycling. So the only part of our economy that's growing, despite this global downturn, despite China's attempt to undermine it, despite Congress being missing in action, is the green part. So that's why I'm excited to be with Presidio.
Yeah, one of the most moving stories in your book is when some guy from the coal industry comes right up to you and says, tell me, are there going to be the jobs? Are you going to wipe us out, in effect? And, it really... it really resonated for me as a reader. I also have to tell you that when you say the biggest failure of the Obama administration is not pushing cap and trade for climate crisis,
yes,
you're saying, in effect, that that's hindered us from this kind of movement toward the green. And
I think we'll look back and we'll say, both from a jobs point of view and from a climate point of view, the biggest letdown was the climate, not getting the climate bill done.
Van Jones is our guest. I'm going to open our phone lines and invite you to join us. His book is Rebuild the Dream and former advisor on green jobs in the Obama administration. Toll-free numbers available whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. You can join us now at 866-733-6786. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls or your emails. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment you have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment, or go to our Facebook page. We'll hear from you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Van Jones, well-known in the Bay Area for founding and leading several locally based social justice and environmental groups. And he rose to national fame through his work on green jobs, which took him all the way to Washington. And now he's written a book about his time in the Obama administration called Rebuild the Dream. It's a memoir and a call to action around his latest passion, student debt and foreclosures. And we're talking with him, and we'll be talking with you in just a moment. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club tonight, April 17th at 6:30 in San Francisco. He's talking a little bit off air about voting and about the disenchantment that many young people, well, not only people of all demographics, I suspect, have about whether or not to exercise their franchise, and that sense of disillusionment with Obama by many who felt that, you know, he would make an extraordinary difference and be the anointed one, as Sean Hannity puts it. Wondering what your take is on that, because I remember Meg Whitman, for example, just came to my attention recently, was hammered for not voting. And we have a major congressional race going on throughout the North Bay and the new district going all the way up. And Norm Solomon and Jared Huffman and Stacey Lawson are pretty much leading the pack. And Stacey Lawson has come under fire for not voting, like Meg Whitman, who once said, I really like Van Jones, and I kind of pulled back on that, I remember. But let's talk about the importance, because both those women happen to have said, well, I didn't think I'd make a difference, and a lot of people feel. And then they become maybe more social conscious, or they want to make a difference, and then suddenly they feel regret about not voting. A lot of people don't feel regret about not voting, though. They just don't vote.
Right. Well, I know, especially for some of the younger folks in particular, and people who were kind of a part of that big hope wave, this is a sense that, well, when we voted, it didn't work. You know, here's what I know, and it's a kind of a clear takeaway lesson. Look at 2008. You can't get everything you want just by voting. 2010. But you can lose everything you've got by not voting. Right, so you get the ballot box is this weird place. You cannot get everything you want there, but you can lose a lot of what you've got there. And so we've got to both vote and march. Now the vote and hope strategy has got to be over. I consider myself to be a post hope Democrat. I'm a post hope progressive. But yeah, I think there's a misunderstanding of history here. You know, no president, even LBJ, who at least on race and class was probably our most liberal president, even LBJ didn't lead the civil rights movement. He was a head of state. He was responsive to the movement. But, you know, it was Fannie Lou Hamer. It was Ella Baker. It was Bayard Rustin. It was Dr. King who were out there leading, and the students leading the civil rights movement.
But on domestic issues, no one was able to pull more strings than LBJ.
Exactly. But because he wanted to get something done. But, I mean, here's what we've got to be able to do. We've got to learn the lessons of 2008 and 2010. What does that mean? Listen, with under Bush, we had the wrong president, but we had the right movement for peace. We had a big movement for peace. People forget about that. We had millions of people in the street for peace. Right movement.
Not like Vietnam,
but in a shorter time frame. But you know, within the first 6 weeks of that thing, we had almost as many people as Vietnam. So here's my quick takeaway on this is, under Bush, you had the wrong president, but you did have the right movement. It was a big movement for peace. Under Obama, you had the right president, arguably, but you had the wrong movement. It was a Tea Party. They were out there. We've got to have the right president and the right movement at the same time. That's the opportunity. If we reelect this president and say that's good, but it's not enough, and we reenergize the movement and fight for these economic and other issues that we're talking about and do it at the same time, we might get more out of the system. But we won't get more out of it if we go back to having the wrong president and the right movement. We got to have both.
What about all those progressives who say Obama's not the right president for me? He's failed me. He's sure. Not done what I wanted. You know, he didn't come through on single payer. He's still breaking promises like the feds running into medical marijuana raids and all that sort of thing. I mean, a lot of disillusionment.
Yeah, well, and a lot of that stuff is just inexcusable. I mean, on the part of the White House. I mean, there's no reason in the world why.
War too, by the way.
War and human rights. I mean, a lot of this stuff is inexcusable. And nobody need make any apology for it. The question is, what is our strategy going forward? Obviously, just electing this guy was not enough. At the same time, you can't argue that things would have been better under a McCain or under a Romney or under a Palin. So we have to be as sophisticated as the system we're trying to change. And so that requires that we both vote smarter. I love people like Norm Solomon and other folks who are out there who are trying to make sure that the people who we send to Congress are better. But we also have to march, rally, protest, and fight smarter. And I know a lot of people in the Bay Area kept up the fight. But across the country, a lot of people, at the time we should have been standing up to the Tea Party, were sitting down. And so I think some of the stuff is inexcusable. I can't imagine how you can live in a country where you have Trayvon Martin's killer wandering the streets still with his gun for 40-plus days, and we're putting people in jail because they're trying to help people with medical marijuana. That, I mean, that's nuts. But you know, that said, one still has to have an attention to 3 years from now, 4 years from now, what are the things we have to have in place to be able to change the conditions under which people are suffering? And I don't think the sort of throw one's hands up approach, or say we're only now going to protest and we won't vote at all. I don't think that it just doesn't make sense to me strategically.
Again, our guest, Van Jones, his new book, Rebuild the Dream. Our first caller is you, TJ. You're on.
Good morning, and really a pleasure to hear you speak. I wanted to just talk about that mortgage forgiveness program that you're pushing for. I'm a renter, and I'm just a little jealous of the idea of anyone forgiving someone's mortgage entirely here, but at the same time, I can see that there's a need for this. I just wanted to suggest that since you're in San Francisco, there is a San Francisco low-income housing program, and here's what they do, which could be adapted for such a program. They kick in on the equity, and so what you could do here is convert some of this mortgage balance into equity and make it come due on the sale. If the house is sold for a profit, that equity is repaid, plus it shares in any additional profit in proportion to it. That way, at least, these things, these banks or these lenders, the FHA, they aren't taking an immediate loss on the loan, which we have to pay for. There's a prospect for actual profit down the road. Mm-hmm. Property values will come back.
Well. First of all, that's a very creative idea and a good idea. And part of what we need is somebody who's overseeing Fannie and Freddie, who's open to creative ideas like that. Part of the reason that I think it's important that we begin to reduce the principal, however we get there, is it's a question of moral hazard. People say, well, we don't want to reward these crazy, bad, awful home buyers who've got these big loans. They must be punished. We must make them suffer. Look, I've got two kids, two little boys. They get into a fight. I don't put one in time out and give the other one lollipops. If they're both doing something wrong, they both need to suffer some consequences. If we were foolish as homeowners to take the loans, the banks were foolish to give the loans. So we both need to pay a cost here. American homeowners have been paying the cost. It's time for the banks to share in the pain. When things are good, they like to share in the gain. They need to share in some of the pain so we can move forward. And it's good for everybody. It'll save neighborhoods from blight, and it'll create a million jobs.
As a listener says, just once I'd like to hear Van Jones' thoughts about the role of out-of-wedlock births, gang violence, drugs, and rampant criminality that has ravaged inner-city neighborhoods in Oakland, Los Angeles, and elsewhere. I understand the appeal of green jobs, but I don't see how those kinds of communities will ever make economic progress until they resolve some of their underlying, this is a quote, cultural problems. Doesn't Mr. Jones have something to say about this?
Well, I mean, it reminds me of the things that my dad used to talk about. He grew up in abject poverty. He grew up in the segregated South. He put himself through college. He put his little brother through college. He put his cousin through college. He put me and my sister through college. And then he turned around and worked in a public junior high school to help a lot of kids get out of poverty. And he was tough on kids. And he said, look, you've got to stick up for yourself. You got to be a decent person. You got to be a decent human being. Nobody, I think, on the left is saying that irresponsible individual behavior on the part of young people is to be tolerated. But the problem is we want to hold our young people to very high standards, and we got to hold adults to even higher standards to make sure that we're doing all we can to give those kids a shot. We still live in a state, California, where we're spending $150,000, $170,000 per year per kid to lock them up. You could send three kids to Yale today for the cost of sending one kid to jail in California. As long as you have those kinds of lopsided spending priorities, we're basically feeding what we're fighting. You take a kid who's marginally in trouble, you put him in a prison-like condition for 9 months or 18 months, you send him back home. You're basically running a $100,000, $150,000 a year prep school for adult prison. As long as the grown folks are acting that stupidly, it's hard for me to insist that the young people can figure it out all by themselves.
Another listener says the cutting of government entitlements and services is not about patriotism. It is about economics. It's highly ironic that a guy like Van Jones would paint this with a patriotic brush.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. I mean, first of all, it is about patriotism. If you do well in America, you should do well by America. It's a lot easier to become a millionaire or a multimillionaire or a billionaire in this country than it is in Bangladesh or Malawi. Why? Because we, as a society, have set our business people up to succeed, and thank God we have. If you're a business person, you don't have to invent the internet and put in all the wiring yourself. You can plug right in. You can take your product to market on roads that we paid for. You can hire young people. You don't have to teach them algebra. We taught them for you in public schools. You turn the water on. It's clean. You don't have to pay to filter it. You don't have to pay a bribe. You can go down to the courthouse and enforce your contract free of charge. Why? because we pay for that as taxpayers, so you can do well. Now, if you do badly, we don't punish you. But if you do well, you should pay your country back and pay those taxes. Pay your country back so we can do it again for the next person and the next person. That's how America works. That's how our grandparents did it. They paid many more percentages in taxes at the upper income, and they didn't complain about it. They were proud to do it. And so, again, this fantasy that if we just let people take advantage of America, let big global corporations come here and do whatever they want to, and then, you know, dodge their taxes, they will be a great country, is a complete lie. It's a joke. It's not true. And we need to honor the wisdom of our grandparents and our parents who built this country and do what they did so we can give our kids as good a country as we got.
And we go to more of your calls. Hugh joins us from Oakland. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. Two things. On the housing side, we found out in our neighborhood because of a neighbor who lost their home to foreclosure in a middle-class neighborhood in Oakland that Bank of America, who foreclosed on them, had another division, investment division called BMI or something, who scooped up the mortgage on the other side. And I wanted to know if Van Jones knows about this practice. And then secondly, on another note, whether you're aware of SOCAP, social capital markets, and benefit corporations and their potential. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm definitely aware of social capital markets. I'm definitely aware of the B Corps. One of the great things that's happening now is that we are seeing a lot more innovation. We're seeing some of America's, the young folks who are going to business school right now, they want the green classes. They want the classes in social entrepreneurship. They want the classes in how can I use my business acumen to treat the earth better and to treat people better and to make better products and do it in a way that's earth-friendly. In order for them to be able to go from sort of a niche kind of boutique play in the U.S. economy to being not the alternative but being the mainstream, America's government has to become a partner to the problem solvers in our economy, not the problem makers. America's government is still a partner to big oil. BP today made $60 million in profit. How do I know? They make that every day. Net. That's after the oil rigs, after the advertisement. Net profit, $60 million. Why does a company making $60 million a day need subsidies from the U.S. government? Why shouldn't some of the people who are trying to make the B Corps and other things work get some of that support, or at least let the playing ground be level? That is part of what's wrong with the country. America's government should not be, you got some people say, well, starve America's government. You have people, so-called patriots. We want a Grover Norquist. We want to cut taxes so much that we'll starve America's government so we could drown it in a bathtub. That's not a patriotic statement. You want to drown America's government in a bathtub? That's Grover Norquist, a great leader. So there's something wrong with this cheap patriotism, with this extreme kind of economic liberty view, has taken over the conversation and the deeper forms of patriotism that really honor our parents and our grandparents' approach to how we built a great country is being left by the wayside.
Are you concerned about the green movement being too white, not enough people of color?
Well, yeah.
I mean, it's always been a criticism, and it continues to be a criticism.
Sure. Well, a lot of it has to do with how you define the green movement. If you mean the green movement, you know, only the great and important concern about our sister and brother species and the long-term, you know, long-time horizon phenomena, yes, we definitely need to do some work.
Well, you've got 600,000 members of Rebuild the Dream now.
Sure.
Do you know how many are people of color?
We don't have the stats on that. You know, Green for All, which is another group I was blessed to play a role in getting started, is, you know, focused on this very question. You know, it's led by Phaedra Ellis Lampkins, who's one of the great leaders of her generation coming up now. And they do have, I think, presence in 50 cities, a lot of people of color. Here's the trick, I think, with the next wave of environmental activism. The green economy is certainly good for our sister and brother species, but it's also good for our sisters and brothers. It's the best way to drive more work, more wealth, and better health to people who don't have it. It is a work, wealth, and health agenda. There are going to be a lot more jobs for people weatherizing homes, putting up solar panels, building wind turbines, putting those up, growing organic food than we're going to have in the coal mines over the next 20 years. And so you've got to begin to understand that it's also not just an elite agenda for people who want to spend more money on green products. It's also got to work for people who want to earn more money in new jobs and save more money. And so, but the green economy can work both for the people at the top end and at the bottom end, and most importantly, for future generations as well.
When you left the White House, and a lot of that was over that flap about being signer number 46 on a petition that supposedly said that we needed investigation of the Bush administration and other higher-ups in the American government being involved in 9/11, and you've repudiated that and said, you know, didn't sign the petition. It came under so much scrutiny, particularly by people like Glenn Beck. But you said in the book that you really felt it your duty to some extent to resign at the time because you felt it would put too much pressure on health care and it would actually interfere with health care getting through. Really, what I'm interested in now, are you satisfied that because we got the Supreme Court, maybe Justice Kennedy is the most powerful man in the world right now in terms of health care, but are you satisfied that health care is going to continue to move through in terms of the Pelosi, Rahm Emanuel, Obama dream of what it was supposed to be?
Well, I mean, something has to happen moving forward. I mean, you know, first of all, again, as I've said a million times in every interview and probably will have to say until I'm 97 years old, I never saw the petition. I never signed the petition. Somebody typed my name on a website. And even the 911 Truth Organization itself came out months later and said, okay, look, we don't have the guy's signature. So that was either a mistake or some stunt. I have no idea. But what I will say about it is this. The part of the reason that we're having the problem right now with this healthcare thing is because the left was not loud enough and not strong enough for single payer. If we had been loud and strong and proud for single payer, the public option would have looked like what it was, a moderate compromise to sort of have a mixed system with some private and some public, you know, Medicare for more people.
You know that President Obama promised in his campaign that there would be single payer.
Well, I there's some stuff that's not excusable, but my only point is that there was with the D.C. grass tops crowd, the abandonment of single payer was total, and then we wind up with this moderate compromise public option looking like the left wing position, which then that got knocked off, and then you wind up with this individual mandate. The individual mandate is a Republican idea. It says individuals need to take responsibility. Well, once that becomes into law, then the Republicans move even further to, I don't know, I guess not to the right, just out of reality, and the Republicans become the pro-moocher, pro-freeloader caucus and say, no, just dive bomb yourself into an emergency room. Don't worry. The government will take care of it. So you got two things going wrong here. You have a right wing that is so unprincipled that it will shoot at any idea, even its own ideas, to hit the president. And then you have a left wing that was not strong enough institutionally to stand up for the actual right answer, which is single payer. You don't need private insurance companies for health care. I mean, you buy insurance for something if you aren't sure. Well, maybe there'll be a flood. So maybe I should buy insurance. Maybe I shouldn't. We know everybody in America is going to have to see a doctor at some point, so that you don't need private insurance companies. And had we been able to make that case louder, then the compromise to the public option would have made more sense. And then the Supreme Court would not be focused on the individual mandate because, say, listen, you either pay for the public health care system like you pay for public roads and public schools, or you buy your own, no issue. So when the left gets quiet, the country gets worse, and even the moderates' position cannot survive.
I'm remembering a video I saw of you, which I'm sure you recall, where a young woman said to you, how come the right is able to push all these things through and be so much more successful and get things done? And you said, it's a word that I can't use on air, because they're a-holes. It was essentially what you said. And there's a lot of laughter, but in a sense, I mean, it was a funny moment, and certainly that crowd appreciated very much. You really feel that way?
Well, no. You know, it's funny. You know, politics is a contact sport. And you
it's
know,
a blood sport, but contact sport.
Exactly. You know, we all are of two minds in politics. That's a great thing about it. You love your team, you want your team to win, but you also love the country. And so, at any particular moment, somebody might be high minded or somebody might be profane, but you can't define anybody by their highest, most enlightened comment or by their barbed little side comment. You got to look at somebody's whole journey through life. And I think I've been pretty consistent. I'm passionate about the people who get screwed over in American life. I try to be innovative with solutions. I can be colorful and funny, and sometimes that you pay a price for that. But, it's politics.
Here's a listener from Berkeley who says, big fan of Van here, did some plumbing at his house, but how the hell are we really going to change the bank's unfair communications on interest calculations of school debt? I'm 53, have a small loan with a student debt company for one of my kids. I'm 5 months ahead on my payments. The daily compounding of interest is a killer. I could go on about the ridiculous communications, and I am a grown-up. The kids have been sucked into unfair lending practices, not at all like when I had school loans. And question, who in the government is watching this?
Well, you know, we do have that new agency, which Elizabeth Warren probably could have and should have headed up. She's in a tight race in Massachusetts now. You know, Wall Street is pouring in a ton of money to try to stop her from becoming a senator.
She's getting a lot of money, too, though. From,
yeah, that's good. I hope she gets as much support as she possibly can. The good thing about what she's pointing out is we do have candidates now. You got Norm Solomon. You've got Elizabeth Warren. There are people who understand what ordinary people are going through, these kitchen table issues. When you get to Washington, D.C., that stuff, it gets so tiny in the conversation. It's all about the subcommittee of the subcommittee and this aide and that thing. It's so inside baseball bubble talk that people forget there are folks out here hurting.
Yeah, and, excuse me for a moment, but yeah, sure. In your book you say that people forget about the elves. They forget, I mean, or don't really see them. They're the invisible people, the interns, the cooks, the
security guards.
Security guards makes me think of Columbia, but we won't go there necessarily. Secretaries, assistants, that these are people who are really shaping much of policy, more than we realize.
Yeah, the most amazing thing I found, and I think it's probably especially true in the Obama administration, but I don't know because I wasn't close to the Bush administration, the ordinary working folks who go into that building, go in the White House every day, who go into the buildings next to it, the White House campus every day. I mean, just ordinary working folks. The level of competence, the level of dedication, the smarts that is accumulated in the civil service corps there is unbelievable. These people are some of the smartest people, and they could be teaching at Harvard, but they're acting as secretaries and security guards in that building. And they took me under the wing when I was there. They saw that I was kind of a kid of the working class, you know, kind of wandering out there from California.
The guy said, Oceans? What's Oceans?
I know.
That's a very funny story. Comes into the White House. He says, what do you do? The guy says, Oceans. Oceans, what's that an acronym for? What is it? What is Oceans?
Yeah.
No, Oceans, you know, like the big water.
Yeah, because everything in D.C. is an acronym. And so when somebody says even a simple word like Oceans, you assume they must be talking about some agency you've never heard of. And the guy, no, he was actually talking about the seas. And I was like, okay, I got a lot to learn here.
Web comment. The failure of Solyndra also shows there's no guarantee that American employers will have success in the green marketplace. They also cannot be expected to create high-paying middle-class jobs while competing against cheap Chinese labor. Already, many infrastructure projects, including high-speed train projects, are sourcing from foreign countries. While the green job program may be the right thing to do, may be overrated in its potential.
Well, I think that's worth discussing. You certainly can't do it piecemeal. You've got to have a comprehensive strategy. You know, our friends in China have a comprehensive strategy, and we don't. And at some point, we've got to look at that. If you want to do it the right way, you do what the president did. You would put $80 billion on the table, as he did, to jumpstart the clean economy, and that's what he did in the stimulus package. You'd follow that up with cap-and-trade rules to get the private sector to play, and you'd defend the country, the WTO, from China. And then you would have the public sector playing a proper role. You'd have the lion's share of the piece being done by private companies, but they'd be protected. That is not happening, and therefore, you know, I think we're mistreating American companies.
Another Solyndra email here that I want to read to you. Brian writes, I find it odd that you associate the Chinese government subsidies as the cause for the Solyndra failure when, in fact, it was an inherent flaw in their business model. Solyndra's innovative tubular panels relied upon historically high prices for silicon, which, of course, is a derivative of sand. Mm-hmm. Microeconomic principles played out when supply caught up to demand for silicon, prices plummeted, and Solyndra's cost structure was no longer sustainable. I do believe in green technology, but wouldn't it be better to eliminate some of the subsidies for fossil fuels to allow consumers to feel their true cost, thus allowing the mechanics of the free market to determine the energy sources of the future?
Yes, I agree that getting rid of the subsidies and also, frankly, having a price on carbon, either through cap and trade or carbon tax, would be a big piece of it. However, you still have to invest in the technologies of tomorrow, and R&D has been an appropriate and, frankly, esteemed role for the U.S. government by both sides of the political aisle. You know, part of, and we can't do a whole show on Solyndra, but part of the good thing that came out of Solyndra, there were real breakthroughs, technological breakthroughs there. The business model had some flaws in it, but that's going to be true in general. But the real pressure came from the flooding of the world with cheap solar panels, which didn't give them the opportunity to correct and to get back on their feet. We can't do a whole show on Solyndra. Energy is tricky and energy is special. And we don't have a fair conversation about energy. People say, well, we don't want America's government getting involved in the energy sector. That's kind of like saying, we don't want America, get your government hands off my Medicare. America's government is already, energy in any country in the world is a public-private play. The question is, are you thinking about the future, the long term? Are you being fair to all players? And right now, we are so favoring the dirty technology, and we don't talk about what it means when you're subsidizing a company like BP and you have this massive oil spill. You don't talk about that. But we do talk about when you have one company go down like Solyndra. And I think that's an unfortunate reality of American politics right now.
So people who want to join up, Rebuild the Dream?
Rebuildthedream.com. Rebuildthedream.org is a little bitty group. Then they're a little mad at us now. So don't go there. Go to rebuildthedream.com and help us fight back.
Well,
on
you got the business domain.
Exactly.
Ben Jones here with us, co-founder of Rebuild the Dream, former advisor on green jobs, the Obama administration. He founded the group, L. Baker Center for Human Rights, which many are familiar with in the Bay Area. And he'll be speaking tonight at the Commonwealth Club at 6:30 p.m. Good to have you with us.
I'm so glad to be here.
Thank you for being with us, and thank you, our listeners, for being with us. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. And remind you that you can also carry or continue this conversation on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and click on this segment, or continue discussion on our Facebook page, which we invite you to become a part of. You can always let us know what you think about what you hear on forum also by emailing us at forum@kqed.org. And we've got Jacques Pepin coming up in the hour ahead, so we're going to relax and talk about culinary things. Thank you for being with us. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our producers are Judy Campbell and Christina Russo is with us now, and our engineer is Danny Bringer. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, who believe all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.